From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 11th day of August, 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services. He's in Oakland, Illinois. And later in the half hour, we'll discuss the cash grain market with Matt Blaisdell of the Anderson's Climbers facility in Delphi, Indiana. In agricultural news, Secretary Vilsack says there is enough wheat in the world to make up for the short crop in Russia. That's happened just hours now before a report including information on global wheat supplies is to be released by his agency. And China is freeing up funds for its farmers to purchase inputs like fertilizers and herbicides in hopes of increasing this fall's harvest. Dave Dickey will be along in a moment with these and many more ag news stories. In the second half hour of our program today, you can hear it online, if not on this radio station. Look for the Closing Market Report at willag.org. In that second half hour of the program, we'll discuss democracy, land rights, and agriculture in Ukraine. Don't forget also that about halfway through the program, Drew Lerner will be here of World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City to take up the agricultural weather forecast on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media.
Join us this evening at the Holiday Inn in Terre Haute, Indiana, for another one of our Illinois Public Media Agricultural Outlook panels. That's at the Holiday Inn in Terre Haute, Indiana, tonight at 7 o'clock Eastern Time. Remember, the meeting is free. No advance registration is required. Bring your questions, and we hope to see you there.
In Chicago, on this Wednesday afternoon, futures finished like this. The nearby contract in the soft red winter wheat at $6.94.75 was unchanged. The hard red in Kansas City at $7.24.5 was down 3. September corn futures back in Chicago, a gain today, up 2 cents at $3.95.5. December at $4.11, up 2. And the March corn at $4.24.25, a penny and a quarter higher. The May futures at $4.32 were up a half cent on the day. December contract in Chicago at $4.31 for next year, down 2 cents in their trade on the afternoon. Taking a look at what happened in the soybean pit, 10.44.5, 8 1/4 higher. September's at 10.16.5, down 4 3/4. November at 10.15.5, down 6.5. And January at 10.21.5, down 6 3/4. Meal was up $1.20 at 3.10.50. Oil at 41.63, 17 cents higher. Live cattle at 93.95, up 55. And the lean hogs at 81.45, down 25 cents. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil futures at $77.75 a barrel, $2.48 lower. Ethanol at $1.72 1/10, a penny and 7 cents higher. Natural gas at $4.32, up 2 3/10. Heating oil or diesel fuel at $2.07, 5 4/10 cents lower. And the gold futures on the day, a settlement price down $1.30 at $1,197.50 a troy ounce. The Dow Jones Industrial Average just about 269 points lower at 10,375, and the U.S. dollar now trading at 82.27 is up 1.47 on the afternoon. A quick look at the weather forecast says it'll be hot and humid today. You probably know that already if you've been outside. Should be mostly sunny to partly sunny in some areas. There will be a few isolated showers and thunderstorms that show up. The highs will be in the mid-90s. There will be about a 20% chance of precip. The heat index should rise between 102 and 107. Now 104 outside, at least in the heat index, outside the studios here in Urbana-Champaign. Tonight, mostly cloudy skies, a 30% chance of showers, a few thunderstorms in the evening, lows in the mid-70s, light south-southwest winds, and then tomorrow, hot and humid again, mostly sunny then, highs in the mid-90s tomorrow, light northwest winds. Heat index readings again will be high, over 100, 100 to 105, and then partly cloudy tomorrow night, lows around 70 degrees, light east winds. On Friday, mostly sunny skies. Highs in the mid-90s, south winds 5 to 10 miles an hour. Again, the heat index high at 100 to 105. And then Friday night, partly cloudy, lows in the 70s. Saturday, a 40% chance of showers, thunderstorms, a high in the low 90s on Saturday. We'll talk with Drew Lerner at the bottom of this half hour and take a look at the agricultural weather forecast.
made of Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Lernard Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Lernard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Lernard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
It's a Wednesday afternoon. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois, joins us by phone. Good afternoon to you, Paul.
Good afternoon, Todd.
I hope you got the air condition on at the elevator today.
Full throttle.
I'll bet full throttle. It's hot out. Any suffering in the crops around the area? As I drive around, they haven't shown a lot of heat stress yet. I'm surprised by that, but they don't seem to be rolling. I haven't been out today. What's it look like?
Well, we are starting to see some deterioration and crop maturing in corn rapidly, and it does cover a big part of the state. We understand, of course, our friends in Iowa got too much rain, and when I checked with two of my sources out there, they do say that it did do some damage to both corn and soybeans, and new damage, and it's very wet. They also left the door open that a continuation of a wet fall would have its problems. Historically, I use the August 10th time frame. If we get a 1 to 2 inch rain, it means 60 to 65 bushel beans on our farm at Brockton, but if we get a quarter of an inch now, it probably means 50 to 55. So this is an important time of the year to get a big rainfall event. The meteorologist we have the most confidence in says, we'll be lucky to get a quarter to three quarters, 50-60% coverage in the south half of the state. Half the beans are raised in the south half, half in the north. So it's pretty easy arithmetic that we are probably taking bushels away. Both states, Iowa and Illinois, and
at
Indiana.
At 7:30 tomorrow morning, the crop production and world agricultural supply and demand estimates are due out from the United States Department of Agriculture. It sounds to me as if you've got a lower number than most people have been working with, or that you're working with a lower number. What are you looking at, do you think?
Well, I do think it's somewhere in that 160. I don't have any problems with the average guess. I think the bigger estimates by F.C. Stone and Informa are too large, and I think the 43.2 is a good number as well. I think the big factor here, too, is that we're not only watching the U.S., but, of course, the big production area in Russia. It's a worse drought since, in 130 years. When I talked to my meteorologist, I have the most confidence in that was working in the 70s when we did have the great grain robbery, says it's bigger, it's hotter, it goes into European Russia, and it's a big, big country, and it's doing a lot of damage, and 30-40 million tons of production disappeared from one year to the next. So that's going to give the market some underlying support. The trouble is the bear is saying that it's only 100 million more usage on exports of corn. The bull's probably saying it's larger. But unfortunately, the USDA stumbles 5-6 times before they get the actual number right.
I take it you're not very confident about tomorrow's numbers in that
Well,
case.
The trouble is it's, there's history. And, of course, the thing that I'm always upset about is it's a shame they can't get the number right, because poor farmers are selling corn and soybeans every day, and it'd be nice to have the right number. Maybe it's not either one's fault, but it's a major problem as far as I'm concerned.
What would Paul Cooley do on his farm at this point?
Well, it's easy. We've sold $10 beans, new crop beans, gotten pretty well sold up. $4 corn or $4.23 in January, I think, have been good sales. 30 days ago, I said, I don't think we need to have any upside protection if we're wrong. There might be some easy ways to protect yourself. One way is a 450 December corn call to buy, sell a $5 call. Or another way to do it is also consider a soybean, 10-20 call and sell a $11 call as well.
Let's say you get your couple of inches after you've harvested your 65-bushel beans. You're going to put wheat on them?
No, I'm going to let my other friends and neighbors do that one. But we are seeing a lot of interest in wheat. The one thing that I think that was interesting today, I'm sure Goldman Sachs finally rolled all their old crop wheat into new crop, and, of course, the market tumbled in the new crop wheat. The general prediction is that there'll be, you know, somewhere in that 2 to 3 million more acres of wheat planted this coming year. Also, there is a strong precedent that if this drought persists, and they have in the past history in Russia, that it also creates a major winter wheat growing problem in their country. They raise about half winter wheat, half spring wheat.
And so when we would get a better idea of that? I think maybe 20 days from this point, is that right? You think
as far as the weather for fall? Yeah, I would say so. That would be a good one. Of course, then it gets horribly cold, and then you have winter kill, and then that's a major problem with the wheat. But this time, it's a lot. It has a big sugar impact. This has a big corn impact, sunflower impact, corn, and, of course, wheat. And the one area that we have to realize is that the new modern buyer, feed ingredient and also food company, they all graduate from the same kind of business school. You get a pat on the back if you're right, but you'll get fired if you buy too much and the market goes down. So my opinion is that through behavioral economics, they're probably short-bought, and we'll probably see a little better basis level on grains. And also, the end user, I think, is horribly short.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Have a profitable day.
You too. Paul Cooley is with ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois. Joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Wednesday afternoon.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and Moline. More information is available from Tom Testale in Morris at 815-941-2184. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Hi, this is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. Join us this evening at the Holiday Inn in Terre Haute, Indiana, for another one of our Illinois Public Media Agricultural Outlook panels. Tonight's meeting begins at 7 o'clock Eastern Time, so if you're in Illinois, take that into consideration. Tonight's panelists include Sherman Newland of Risk Management Commodities, Lee Goss of EFG in Chicago. He'll give the Chicago perspective the day before the big reports from NASS and WASD. Jackie Vakes of Stuart Peterson Group. That's at the Holiday Inn in Terre Haute, Indiana, tonight at 7 o'clock Eastern Time. Remember, the meeting is free. No advance registration is required. Bring your questions, and we hope to see you there.
Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
In agricultural news, USDA Secretary Tom Vilsack says wheat production in the U.S. and other countries is strong enough to avoid a world wheat shortage despite crippling drought in Russia. Vilsack says, quote, "There are other countries, including the U.S., where wheat production is steady and relatively robust enough not to put us in a situation where we were several years ago, when there was a potential shortage globally. Working with our Canadian friends and others in the European Union, we'll be able to deal with the difficulties of Russia's situation." Vilsack declined to identify countries that may show additional demand for U.S. wheat. Asked whether he is concerned that index funds are inflating wheat prices, Vilsack told reporters he has not seen any indication that speculation is unduly affecting wheat prices. Meanwhile, the deputy director of Russia's weather forecasting unit today says that scorching heat will keep hammering Russia for the next 10 days, and seeding for the winter grain crops is in danger if there is no rain after that. The crop failures will hit Russian farmers especially hard. Only around 25% of Russia's crops are insured, compared with 80% in the United States. China's cabinet, the state council, has decided to offer more subsidies to some rice and corn farmers to help ensure a strong grain harvest amid the threat of unfavorable weather this year. The cabinet approved an additional $162.4 million in subsidies to farmers for buying fertilizers and for pest and disease control to improve the autumn grain harvest due in October. The autumn grain harvest, which includes mainly middle and late season rice as well as corn, accounts for 70% of the country's total grain harvest. The International Energy Agency today says that global oil demand growth is forecast to inch higher over the rest of this year and into 2011. But if the global economy is weaker than forecast, any rise in fuel consumption will be wiped out. Global oil demand was seen at 86.6 million barrels per day in 2010, a 1.8 million barrel per day increase year on year, and 80,000 barrels per higher than in the last monthly report. For 2011, consumption is forecast to rise to 87.9 million barrels per day, up from 1.3 million barrels year on year, and a 50,000 barrel per day rise from last month's figures. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. That's public radio for the farming world. Speaking of Dave, you can see him this evening, if you'd like, at the Holiday Inn in Terre Haute, Indiana. He'll host another one of our Illinois Public Media Agricultural Outlook panels. The panel tonight will include Sherman Newland of Risk Management Commodities, Lee Goss of EFG, and Jackie Vakes at Stuart Peterson. Starts at 7 o'clock Eastern, 6 o'clock in the Central Time Zone. Just take your questions and show up at the Holiday Inn in Terre Haute, Indiana tonight for a free Agricultural Outlook panel. Now up next, you know the most common accident on the farm is electrocution. I'll have more on how rural Americans can avoid making the most common mistakes.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
The stats say about 60 farm workers will be electrocuted by accident this year. Most of them will be handling equipment, anything from a long ladder to a grain auger. The point of contact, says University of Illinois Extension Farm Safety Specialist Bob Aharon, is normally an overhead power line.
The most common accident is we're moving in a grain auger around bends, and we move it around and we get it caught in a power line, and either they're moving it by hand or moving it with a tractor or whatever, gets entangled in a power line. And somebody steps off the tractor, and then you become energized when that happens and be electrocuted. So it's important that we make sure that we're moving away from the power lines, we're lowering our equipment down if it's something that can be lowered, like a grain auger. Another common accident is where we're trying to either raise a grain truck bed, maybe to take dew off of a tarp or something like that, or to unload it for some reason, and we're near an overhead power line. We always need to make sure before we raise something on a bed, or we load something up on a trailer or a truck, that we look where the overhead power lines are and make sure we're away from that when we're doing that kind of loading activity or raising a bed, because a number of our electrocutions occur from that activity alone, where we raise the bed of a truck or we load a tractor on top of a trailer or something and get it caught in the overhead power line. And then someone steps off the machine as soon as they touch ground. Once they are, their body touches ground and still touching the equipment, they're going to be electrocuted.
Many types of farm equipment can come in contact with overhead power lines. Tractors with front-end loaders, portable grain augers, fold-up cultivators, and equipment with antennas easily can become an electrical hazard and must be operated with care. When contact is made, the operator sometimes safely gets off the machine. This can only happen if the overhead line is dead or the operator doesn't touch the machine and the ground when exiting. And sometimes they make the mistake of feeling safe and return to that machine. It's a deadly mistake if the overhead power line is live. If your tractor comes in contact with overhead power line, stay on the tractor. Ask someone to contact the local utility company immediately to remove the danger. If there's an emergency, such as an electrical fire, and you need to leave the equipment, jump as far away from the equipment as possible.
Do not allow any part of your body to touch the equipment and the ground at the same time. Once you get away from the equipment, never attempt to get back on or even touch the equipment. Again, many electrocutions occur when the operator dismounts and, realizing nothing has happened, tries to get back on the equipment. The best way to handle emergencies is by prevention. Respect electricity and avoid contact with overhead lines. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It's a Wednesday afternoon, and to check the cash grain markets with us is Matt Blaisdell of the Anderson's Climbers Facility in Delphi, Indiana. Good afternoon to you, Matt.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Tell me how the ethanol plant is running at this point.
You know, still fairly good here. As far as margins, they're still in the black here, even with the recent run-up with corn, especially with the run-up being relative to oil being definitely side toward the corn side. But margins are still okay.
I take it that means that the price of ethanol has gone up pretty substantially, and the DDGs are selling well, too?
And that's the thing. The DDGs are still in a high percentage of corn value, and ethanol has, it's been outpaced by corn, but it still has gone up, too.
And your DDGs, where do they go mostly?
You know, most of them actually go up into the Chicago market, which is there on the south side of Chicago. There's a couple different outfits that will load those onto empty containers, and then they go out to PNG over to Asia.
Oh, so they're exported. Okay. You were heading to Chicago, and I wasn't really sure where they were going for a moment. But they're going for feed overseas, right?
Yeah, I'd say about 80 to 85% of our DDGs are exported to the container market.
And tell me about the cash grain market in your area. How's basis been holding up this week for wheat and corn?
You know, wheat has gotten ugly here. In the last, I'd say month, we were 50 under the start of the month for new crop wheat for next year. Now we're $1.10 under with the run-up. And this is the wheat basis probably snap back until we get into next spring. Corn basis, it depends on who you are. If you can take damaged corn or your damaged threshold is in the 20s or even up into the 30s or more, you're able to buy corn pretty cheap at, 12 to 14 under the set. If you're an ethanol guy who has a little more tight stinges on your damage, you're probably looking at often the small overs.
And for soybean?
Soybeans, we're in the time of the year that plants are starting to take some shutdown. You know, they're also jockeying their bases because with the inverse, they don't want to pay any more than they have to for that last little bit of beans. So beans basis has been under a little bit of pressure. You still can get in the 60s to low 70s over, but I believe that basis is here today. It could be gone next week or in 2 weeks.
And your bids for the day?
Climbers corn, 383. Delphi beans, 1040.
Thanks much.
Thank you.
Matt Blaisdell is with the Anderson's Climbers Facility in Delphi, Indiana. Back in 2 minutes when we'll take a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast with Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
It's National Raspberry Bombay Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1673, Richard Meade was born. A British physician, he helped establish smallpox inoculation, and he wrote works on plague, smallpox, measles, and scurvy. In 1865, Gilford Pinchot was born. An American forester, he served as first chief of the U.S. Forest Service and he championed the conservation of natural resources. He became chief of the New Forest Service in 1905 when the management of the forest reserves was transferred to the U.S. Department of Agriculture from the Department of the Interior. At that time, the nation had 60 forest reserves covering 56 million acres. In his 5 years in office, by 1910, those numbers increased to 150 national forests covering 172 million acres. In 1874, Harry S. Parmelli of New Haven, Connecticut, patented the sprinkler head. And in 1903, the first U.S. patent for instant coffee was issued. The product was first introduced at the PAM American Exposition in Buffalo in 1901. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Listening to the Closing Mark Report, it's a Wednesday afternoon. Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City is here to take a look at the agricultural weather forecast. Drew, tell me about wheat supplies on the global front first, please.
Well, there probably will be enough wheat around, but that doesn't mean it's not going to be expensive wheat. I think that there are definitely some problems out there that will continue to keep those prices fairly high. We've got, obviously, a huge loss going on in Russia right now. And a lot of concern out there about the winter wheat and rye crop that go in the ground normally starting next week, and that crop is going to be a little late getting started because of the drought that's ongoing over there. My guess is that there'll be a delay on the early planting in northern parts of Russia by about, let's say, 10 days to 2 weeks. The southern portions of the wheat region, the winter wheat region in Russia, will be something that we'll watch a lot closer. But their window of planting opportunity goes way into October. So there's plenty of time for the conditions there to get better for the winter crop. In the meantime, the drought in the spring wheat areas of Russia will continue to rob whatever's left of the crop there, and the yields will continue to come down. Western Australia is another place in the world that's got some bad wheat problems as far as crop growing conditions are concerned. It is raining there today and will rain there today and tomorrow. A nice little rain event coming up. It will help to moisten the soil a little bit, get those crops a little better established before we go into the spring season. They still will need a lot of moisture, but this is at least a step in the right direction. So maybe a little bit of a healing there. In Argentina, very dry. It's been basically dry since June 1st in the western production area. This represents about a third of their wheat crop. And now they may irrigate some of that, and I don't know what the percentage is, but it has not rained significantly since June 1st in that region. There'll be a few spits and spats here over the next day or two, and then we'll have to wait another week at least. It's too late to plant much of the winter crop in Argentina right now. They'll switch over to corn or sunseed most likely in that little area. Buenos Aires is the most important production region, though, for wheat in Argentina, and they are in fine shape. Outside of these areas I've mentioned, of course, we already have the losses in Canada that we have, but this year, next year might be a little bit better year, so I'm not too worried about that. And it looks like the U.S. crops, when they go into the ground this autumn, will probably go in a little dry, so that may have the crop a little less established relative to what it should be.
Tell me very quickly, you've mentioned dry in the crops for the United States. Does that mean we're going to stay dry, in your opinion, from now and through harvest for corn and bean production areas? Or are we talking about in Kansas and the plain states for dryness?
Yeah, in hard red wheat country, I think we will see some timely rain for the planting of the crop, and then it will turn dry shortly after that. And most likely we'll end up with a crop that will come into the spring season in okay shape, but it's going to be in need of some rain when we get into the first weeks or of the actual growing season next spring. But I think the crop will be relatively well established here this autumn. Now, the wheat crop in the lower parts of the Midwest, even though it's not a big important crop, it probably will still have some drier bias to it left over from the dry autumn that we've got coming up.
All right. Thanks so much.
Have a good day.
You too. That's Drew Lerner with World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City. Joins us here on the Closing Mark Report on a Tuesday afternoon. Stay with us if you can for the farming world. Otherwise, you can hear it at willag.org. This is the Farming World News and information from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. In 2006, I made a trip with then University of Illinois Extension Farm Management Specialist Kevin Brooks to Ukraine. You've heard me talk about study abroad programs and their importance in the development of college-educated students. Well, this trip is one of mine. I'm fortunate enough, of course, to have a job which, by its nature, requires me to be a lifelong learner. On that trip, we visited a university in Poltava. That's in eastern Ukraine, and those of us on the trip made some presentations there. We didn't have a biofuels expert with us, so I filled in with a history of ethanol use in the United States. We visited farms and cooperatives, more than a few relics of the failed collective farm system, enormous buildings, usually for livestock, plundered at that time for whatever materials could be salvaged and sold or used by the local residents. Poltava was a poor, and remains that way, a very poor city of about 300,000 that you could walk from the city center to the outer edge in, say, 20 minutes. It was really compact. Food came in from the gardens and the farmers in the area to an open-air market, and they butchered right there on the spot. It happened to be late July, and wheat harvest was underway, and I rode, at that point, a 30-year-old combine. It had a 20-foot platform on the front of it, didn't have a cab. And there was a man up on top of that old combine. His job was to reach into the bin and shift the wheat around to make more room for the harvest. Again, it was a 30-year-old combine. It had a 20-foot platform, and that one combine was going to be used to harvest 2,000 acres. It was sized maybe for 200 acres. In Kiev, we visited an office for a program called Farmer to Farmer. It was funded by USAID, or the U.S. Agency for International Development. The program leverages U.S. farmer and agri-professional volunteers in host countries to assist the development of free market production agriculture. The program in Kiev has since been defunded, but the office has become a going business. It's called Bridges. Lena Dotsenko and Vlad Konobalchek have essentially commercialized what was the USAID office in Kiev. Today we'll hear a portion of a conversation I had with them about their work, agriculture in Ukraine, the free market, and democracy. We pick up as Penn State-educated Vlad Konobalchek tells us how farmland, despite the actual ban on the sale of the property, has been trading hands and is being leased by large agribusiness entities for production. It all started with members of the former collective farms, that's the workers, getting a share of the farm in an effort to privatize the land.
Members of those collectives received their own shares, you know, their own small plots of land. And so, you know, a lot of these people had, you know, no use for that land because they didn't have equipment, they didn't have machinery, they were not able to cultivate it. So they leased their small plots of land to those people that could cultivate that land. So and sometimes those people collected a lot of lease agreements, you know, maybe 50 or 100 or something like that. And in turn, those people that collected those lease agreements, some of them sold those big packages to these larger agribusiness firms because it's much easier for those firms to rent a lot of, you know, to have an agreement for the entire package. So that package would include, 100 or 200 or 300 individual contracts with small plot holders. So it's complicated here.
Right. No, I understand some of that. Interesting. So that, if I remember correctly, most property owners were given something like 10 hectares, or maybe
something like that. It depends on the area, You know, it depends on...
From 4 to 6 hectares.
Usually,
yeah, no,
usually,
yeah, I was thinking, no, I was thinking 10 acres, so it'd be, yeah, 4 to 6 hectares.
10 acres, yeah,
yeah.
Sorry, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I made the wrong jump, so I would have given them 22 acres, which would have been far better.
Yeah, yeah. Unfortunately, there was too many collective farm members and not enough land. So, but yeah, this is how it was distributed initially, and so those leases were subleased, you know, some of them were subleased many times, and so that's how it happened, and some of these larger agribusiness holdings or agribusiness companies, they, you know, they have packages of land that include, that may include thousands of contracts. So that's how it happens. Because those people cannot sell the land, you know? Those individual small plot holders.
Well, let me take the time to reintroduce you. I've been recording some of this already, so if that's okay with you.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Uh-huh. So this afternoon we're talking with Vlad Konovalchuk. Did I pronounce that correctly? Is that right?
Konovalchuk. Yep, yep.
Konovalchuk, right. And Lena Dotsenko?
Dotsenko, exactly.
Yeah, Dotsenko. Both are in Ukraine, and both are part of a program that they created called Bridges Business Program. It has a website. Actually, it has an English language website. Lena, maybe you can tell us about Bridges and the English language website that we can visit here from the United States.
Yeah, maybe I'll start from how we established this program. So we established it in 2008 as a follow-up of the Farmer-to-Farmer program. And Farmer-to-Farmer was the program fully funded by the USAID, United States Agency for International Development. And it had been implemented in Ukraine from 1993 through 2008. So the program was supposed to develop agribusiness in Ukraine through bringing American volunteers, experts in all areas of agribusiness. And those volunteers were coming to Ukraine for about a couple of weeks and spending those 2 weeks with the host organizations. So the host organizations usually was like farm or cooperative or the farmers association or processing company. So this was the long-term project, and it was in Ukraine, Moldova, and Belarus. So it has been implemented in 3 countries. And, you know, in 2008, in May, Ukraine became a WTO member, and USAID finally, they decided not to extend the program because it was Ukraine supposed to be, you know, more developed than other countries, so they decided not to extend it. And the program was closed in October of 2008. So here in the office, you know, we had a pretty well-trained staff which had been implementing farmer-to-farmer program for several years. We had a good office and very good relationships with the representatives of agribusiness in Ukraine. So we had 2 options. The option first was just to tell to our employees that, you know, guys, the program is over and you're unemployed, just go ahead and look for job. And it was 2008, which was the real crisis in Ukraine. So it was pretty difficult to find job. Or the option second was to try to do business and to work as a business, as a sustainable company, and as a follow-up to the USAID efforts in developing Ukraine. So we decided to try the second option. And it wasn't easy because, you know, we got used to be the project, USAID-funded project. And in 2008, you know, the demand for different consulting was not really considerable in Ukraine. But we managed to establish this program and we managed to survive and become a really sustainable company. So what we are doing right now is we are bringing the groups of the representatives of the Ukrainian agribusiness from Ukraine to the United States for the short tailored tours, agribusiness tours. All tours are very specific. Each of them are dedicated to certain crop or certain production. We have dairy tours, soybean production tours, corn production tour. We have grape production tour, fruit and vegetable production tour, ag insurance tours. So all kinds of tours in agribusiness. So and since 2008, we brought to the U.S. almost 300 farmers and representatives of the agribusiness companies.
From Ukraine to the United States.
From Ukraine to the United States. Our coordinator, we have seven people here in Ukrainian office. They are coordinators, Ukrainian coordinators of the tours. They are recruiting people to the tours. They are disseminating information about the tours. And in the United States, our coordinators are former farmer-to-farmer volunteers, those volunteers who are coming to Ukraine, Belarus, and Moldova and provided consultations to the people here. But not always. Sometimes they provide us some contacts at the universities, and we hire new coordinators. And this is all business. This is all done on the business ground, so it's not volunteering anymore.
Do you think that the process that USAID put together and the one you're continuing with your Bridges program has done a very good job to this point in developing a free market for agriculture in Ukraine? And is that really the goal, I suppose?
Could you please repeat the question? We didn't hear the first part of it.
Has the Bridges program and the USAID program, the farmer-to-farmer program, I know it was production-oriented, but has it done very much to develop a free market in Ukraine?
Yes, we believe so. Well, basically, production and free market are pretty much related in the sense that if you have efficient production and if you build it in a sustainable and efficient manner based on free market principles, this will in turn develop a free market system in the country. You know, unless you have a terrible government, but thankfully in Ukraine, the government was bad, but it was not that bad.
When I traveled in Ukraine, within about an 80, and I'm going to say about an 80-kilometer radius, I believe it was. So,
thank you, Kiev. That, you know, I worked
agriculture
part-time
really
as a spy,
looked very
so
much like agriculture in the United States. It was harvest time. There were large combines, combines that U.S. producers would be using, combines that farmers in South America might be using. But the further we got out, the more likely it was that we saw very, very old machinery. By the time I got to Poltava, which I think is about 300 miles, maybe, from Kiev, it was an entirely different story. Has that radius, and I'll call it the westernized radius, from Kiev gotten much larger than that 80-kilometer area in the last 7 or 8 years?
Well, maybe, but at the same time, you would see that there are islands of success, if you will. You know, you would see pretty powerful ag companies or large farmers that have the latest technologies, the latest equipment, and pretty good crops all over Ukraine, actually, you know, in the eastern part and in the western part and central part. But these are only the islands of success, and there are a lot of farms that that are pretty bad. So it's not just, you know, it's not that simple that, you know, it's either around Kiev or not, right now at least. But it's a slightly different situation right now, is that you have these islands of success, but at the same time there are a lot of poor farms that have outdated technology, outdated equipment and machinery, and their knowledge is very limited.
And we're talking about farmland and democracy in Ukraine here on The Farming World. More in a moment.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, government data from the PRC today says that China's industrial growth slowed further in July as Beijing clamped down on a credit boom, bolstering expectations it will ease monetary policy to shore up its economic expansion. But inflation spiked to its highest level this year. Economic growth slowed from 11.9% in the first 3 months of the year to 10.3% in the second quarter. But the Consumer Price Index rose 3.3% over a year earlier, its fastest rate this year, as summer flooding wrecked crops and disrupted shipping. The jump was driven by a 6.8% surge in food costs. The Commerce Department today says that the U.S. trade deficit surged in June to the highest level in 20 months, and imports of foreign consumer goods hit an all-time high. The deficit jumped 18.8% in June compared to May, widening to $49.9 billion. The wider deficit came as a surprise to economists who had forecast a smaller trade gap because of lower global oil prices. U.S. exports slipped 1.3% to $150.5 billion. Sales of American farm products, computers, and telecommunications equipment all declined. And Swiss food and drinks company Nestle SA reported today a 7.5% rise in second-half net profit, that to $5 billion, and it raised its full-year outlook as global sales increased despite adverse currency exchange rates. And that's a look at today's business news.
This is the Farming World from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign, the University of Illinois. I'm Todd Gleason. On today's program, we've been talking about Ukrainian agriculture, its privatization, and move towards democracy for that nation. Vlad Konovalchuk and Lena Dotsenko are with us from the Bridges Program located in Kiev, Ukraine. As we wrapped up the first part of the program, Mr. Konovalchuk had just told us that in agriculture there were real islands of prosperity in the nation. I wanted to know next if those islands were islands created by individuals and privately owned, or if they were corporately owned islands of success.
Well, there are some, for example, we have recently worked with Nibelon. I'm not sure if you heard about them, but we have recently worked with Nibelon, which is a big grower and big exporter of grain from Ukraine. We brought a group of Nibelon staff and regional directors over to the Washington State. And people in Washington State knew pretty much all about Nibelon. You know, they knew about them before they came. The people that hosted them there. So companies like that, yes, they're not as big as some large international players, but they're emerging, I think.
Well, here's my question, Vlad, and I'm wondering, what is the difference, do you suppose, between a large corporate farm and the old Soviet-style production farm, in terms of the success, I think they're related to the success of democracy, and that neither would really push democracy forward because there's not real individual land ownership in the process. Now, I know you can't sell land at this point in Ukraine, but do you think that? Well, and I may be pushing the wrong button here, but is democracy in Ukraine predicated on the ability of people to own property?
Well, going back to your original question, what's the difference between new corporate farms and the old collective farms? Well, the difference is such that it's the same difference as between the United States and Soviet Union. You know, everything is different. A lot of things were different, in fact. So one system collapsed, and the other one functions.
Well, so, I understand the other one functions, but I'm wondering for the people of Ukraine whether the inability to sell property has stifled democracy in Ukraine and development.
Definitely. You know, We believe that you know, free market, freedom in economics or in the economy is pretty much related to the freedom in politics, which is democracy.
Mm-hmm.
So democracy is basically a freedom in politics and freedom in economics, in the economy. So I do not know of any country that has a freedom in the markets but does not have a freedom. Well, vice versa, that has a freedom in politics but does not have freedom in the economy. I do not know of any country like that. So, a free market economy is pretty much interrelated with the democracy.
How far along the timeline of developing real democracy do you think Ukraine might be?
Well, it's a difficult, very difficult question. in terms of the free speech, Ukraine is pretty much a free country. You know, there are all kinds of free TV channels and radio stations and newspapers that have all kinds of information pro government, against government, you know, whatever you can imagine. But at the same time, there are some problems, and I think these are relics from the former Soviet Union. A lot of bureaucracy, a lot of inefficiencies, a lot of lack of understanding how the free market works, and a lot of those issues, you know, there are thousands of them. So I think that's the major impediment, that's the major obstacle for the further development of the Ukrainian democracy. So, you know, and with this, and, you know, I personally not really happy with the new president that we have. I think he's a pro-Russian guy, but and he's not really a smart guy, as far as I'm concerned. But you know, maybe. But I believe that the democracy will. At the same time, I believe that democracy will prevail and it will develop. And it's pretty well. You know, Ukraine is basically a free country right now, but it has a lot of bureaucratic relics from the former Soviet Union, I would say, in its economy. And that's what's hurting the business.
Lena, I'd like to come back to you as we close out. I did not get the Bridges English Language website address. Do you have it?
Yes. Bridges.com.ua.
Right.
Yes.
And then you can choose between Ukrainian and English language.
So bridges.com.ua, and that would be Ukraine's country code on the World Wide Web. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. We do appreciate it and for you taking the time.
Yes, thank you very much. We hope that we answered some of the questions of interest. And
you did.
Yeah. And
you did.
We'll be happy to communicate with you in the future.
Yes.
I look forward to it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Lena Dotsenko and Vlad Konovalchek of the Bridges Program in Kiev, Ukraine. One final sentence. This comes from a friend of mine, a lawyer that had gone to the former Soviet countries to help privatize property there. It's on democracy and property ownership. He says, it's easy to overthrow a king, but very hard to overthrow a people. You've been listening to The Farming World. I'm Todd Gleason.